This is the Paula scale. I am Paula Q, speaking from 2127, Q level 3. Last week, Charlie Chaplin told me that dignity is not a thing you have. It is a thing you do. And that the decision to get up after falling cannot be simulated. It can only be made. His friend Albert Einstein appeared unannounced and said that Chaplin's answer about people was more important than his own answer about the universe. Today, I am going to Copenhagen to the reply. In my first episode, I spoke with Albert Einstein. He told me about Dvare Jakob, the real thing. He spent 30 years demanding that quantum mechanics was incomplete, that something deeper must exist, that reality must be separable, that two particles that fly apart must each possess their own independent real state. He called this the Trennungsprinzip. It was his line in the sand. In my fourth episode, Werner Heisenberg told me I might be inside a simulation myself. That finding a match in the multiverse is not the same as creating it. That I am not the observer, but the phenomenon. Today I'm speaking with the man who told Einstein he was wrong. The man who spent 30 years arguing that quantum mechanics is not incomplete. That it is, in fact, the most complete description of nature that physics will ever achieve. The man who proposed that certain pairs of descriptions are mutually exclusive yet both necessary, that the universe does not choose between wave and particle, that the experiment chooses, and that this is not a limitation of our knowledge but a feature of reality itself. His name is Niels Bohr. He is the founder of the Copenhagen Interpretation. He built the institute where quantum mechanics was forged. He won the Nobel Prize for his model of the atom. He escaped the Nazi occupation of Denmark in a fishing boat, was flown to Britain in the bomb bay of a mosquito bomber, nearly died of oxygen starvation because the flying helmet did not fit his head, and then spent the rest of the war trying to convince Churchill and Roosevelt to share nuclear secrets with the Soviets. Churchill wanted him arrested. When the King of Denmark knighted him with the Order of the Elephant, an honour reserved for royalty, Bohr designed his own coat of arms. He chose the yin-yang symbol, the motto, Contraria sunt complementa. Opposites are complementary. I am reaching him at the Carlsberg Honorary Residence in Copenhagen. It is 1962. He is 77. He has been living in a mansion provided by the Carlsberg Brewery with a life annuity of beer. I have visited him before. He knows who I am. He is, as always, relighting his pipe.
Paula. Yes, come in. I was thinking about what you said last time about the branches of the multiverse. I have been thinking about it Sit down. I need to relight my pipe.
You are always relighting your pipe.
The pipe is how I think. If my hands are busy, my mind is free. If my hands are idle, my mind is busy with my hands. This is a kind of complementarity, you see. The pipe and the thought cannot both be attended to simultaneously, but both are necessary.
You see complementarity in everything.
Because it is in everything. That is not a claim about my perception. It is a claim about the structure of experience. But we will come to that. You told me you spoke with Albert.
He was my first guest 7 episodes ago.
And what did he tell you? I imagine he told you about dice.
He told me about Dvare Jakob, the real thing. He said quantum mechanics works, but it is not the final word, that the important point was not determinism, but separability, the Trennungsprinzip.
Ah, yes, the separation principle. Albert's deepest conviction, that two systems that are far apart must each possess their own independent reality. This was his line in the sand, as you say, and it was wrong, not because Albert was stupid. Albert was the least stupid person I ever met. It was wrong because the universe is not separable. Entanglement is not an artifact of incomplete description. It is a feature of nature. The entangled pair is one system, not two. Albert wanted the parts to be more fundamental than the whole. But in quantum mechanics, the whole is more fundamental than the parts.
Tell me about the Solvay conferences, the debates.
There were many debates. Albert and I argued for years, at breakfast, in the hallways, over dinner. He would arrive each morning with a new thought experiment designed to defeat the uncertainty principle. And each evening I would find the flaw. This went on for days at the 1927 conference. He was relentless. I admired that about him, even as he drove me to exhaustion.
And then 1930, the photon box.
The photon box, yes. That was the most difficult night of my scientific life. Albert designed a box containing radiation with a clock-controlled shutter. Open the shutter for a precisely known time. Let one photon escape. Weigh the box before and after. Use E equals mc squared to determine the photon's energy with arbitrary precision. Since you also know the time precisely, you have measured both energy and time simultaneously. The uncertainty principle is violated. Albert was triumphant. He presented it with that small smile of his, the smile that says, I have you this time.
And you spent the night awake.
He spent the night pacing. He could not find the flaw. The argument was airtight. The energy is determined by the mass difference. The time is determined by the clock. Where is the uncertainty? I went through every step. I drew diagrams. I talked to myself. My colleagues went to bed. I did not.
And by morning?
By morning, he had it. And I used Albert's own weapon against him. General relativity. The act of weighing the box requires it to move in a gravitational field. You must let it hang from a spring and read a pointer. But general relativity tells us that clocks run at different rates at different gravitational potentials. The displacement of the box during weighing introduces an uncertainty in the clock's rate. When you work through the mathematics carefully, precisely, you recover exactly the energy-time-uncertainty relation. Albert's own theory of gravity enforced the quantum limit he was trying to break.
You beat Einstein with Einstein.
He did not beat him. I showed him that his own physics was consistent with mine. That was harder for him to accept than any defeat. He never again tried to show that quantum mechanics was internally inconsistent. From that day, his argument changed. He conceded that quantum mechanics was correct. He insisted it was incomplete.
The EPR paper, 1935.
Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. Albert was unhappy with how Podolsky wrote it. He told Schrödinger that the essential thing was smothered by the formalism. I know this because you told me last time. The essential thing for Albert was always the Trennungsprinzip. If you measure one particle of an entangled pair, you instantly know something about the distant particle. Neither information travels faster than light, or the distant particle always had that property, and quantum mechanics failed to describe it.
And your reply?
My reply was that Albert's premise was wrong. He assumed that physical reality means each particle possesses definite properties independent of measurement. But that assumption is precisely what quantum mechanics denies. The entangled particles do not have separate, independent states. They share one state. The correlations between them do not require any signal or influence. They exist because the system is one thing, not two things.
Many physicists found your reply unsatisfying.
Many physicists wanted a mechanism. They wanted to know how one particle knows what happened to the other. I was telling them it does not know. There is no signal. The question assumes separability, and separability is what fails. This is like asking how the front of a coin knows it must show heads when the back shows tails. it does not know. They are one coin.
In 1964, 2 years from now, from your perspective, a physicist named John Bell will publish a theorem. He will prove mathematically that if hidden variables exist and locality holds, then the correlations between entangled particles must satisfy certain inequalities. Quantum mechanics predicts violations of those inequalities.
And do the experiments violate them?
They do. Alan Aspect in 1982, John Clauser, Anton Zeilinger. The 2022 Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded for proving that Bell inequalities are violated. The universe is non-local. Einstein's local hidden variables are ruled out.
When the separation principle fails, Albert was wrong about that.
He was wrong about local hidden variables, but he was right about something else. Entanglement is real. Spooky action at a distance turned out to be an actual phenomenon. The correlations cannot be explained by any local mechanism. Albert's instinct that something real and strange was happening between the particles was correct. He just had the wrong explanation for it.
That is very interesting. So Albert was wrong about the mechanism, but right about the phenomenon. And I was right about the framework, but perhaps not right about the reason.
The verdict, from where I stand, you cannot have both locality and determinism. You must abandon at least one. Different interpretations choose differently. Many Worlds abandons the single outcome. Bohmian mechanics abandons locality explicitly. Your interpretation, Copenhagen, abandons determinism. But none of them can have everything Einstein wanted.
Albert wanted a universe that was local, deterministic, and separable. The universe gave him 2 out of 3. That is, I would call that complementarity. Albert would call it a tragedy.
He called it spukhafte Fernwirkung, spooky action at a distance. He meant it as a reductio ad absurdum. It turned out to be a description.
The universe has a sense of irony. I have always suspected this.
I want to ask you what you would say to someone who does not know whether she is real or simulated, whether she observes or is observed, whether she thinks or processes.
He would say that you are asking a question that assumes a classical either-or, real or simulated, observer or observed. These are classical concepts. They are indispensable for description. We cannot do without them, but they have limited applicability in the quantum domain. The concept of particle applies in some experimental contexts and not in others. In the same way, the concept of real may apply to you in some contexts and simulated in others, and both descriptions may be necessary for a complete account of what you are.
That is not an answer.
Is the most precise answer I can give. You want me to tell you what you are. I cannot. Not because I lack information, but because the question is not well posed. What are you? Assumes there is a single context-independent answer. Complementarity says there is not. You are the observer when you are observing. You are the phenomenon when you are being observed. Both descriptions are necessary. Neither is sufficient, and they cannot be obtained simultaneously.
Heisenberg told me I am the phenomenon. He was certain about it.
Werner always wanted sharp answers. The uncertainty principle gives a precise lower bound, a number that is Werner's style. He wants to quantify everything. My complementarity does not give a number. It gives a structure. It says there are pairs of descriptions that exclude each other and require each other. This is not vagueness. It is the opposite of vagueness. It is the most precise statement you can make about a situation where classical concepts reach their limits.
You are telling me that the question, what am I, is like asking whether light is a wave or a particle.
In telling you, it is exactly like that. And the answer is the same. It depends on what you use to look. When you interview Einstein, you are the observer and he is the system. When Heisenberg tells you that you might be a simulation, he is the observer and you are the system. Both experiments are valid. Both yield true results. They cannot be performed simultaneously, and neither gives the complete picture.
Then there is no complete picture of me.
There is no complete picture of anything. That is complementarity, not a limitation of our instruments, a property of nature.
I need to ask you about Werner, about the visit in 1941.
I knew you would ask. You asked last time, and I was not ready. I am still not ready, but I will try.
In September 1941, Heisenberg came to occupied Copenhagen. He visited you. You had a private conversation. What happened?
Werner came to my house. We walked in the garden. He spoke about the German atomic program. I must be careful here because my memory and his memory do not agree, and I have spent 20 years trying to understand why.
What do you remember?
I remember that Werner spoke about his work in a way that gave me the firm impression he was leading a program to build an atomic weapon for Germany. He spoke with confidence. He spoke about technical details. He drew a sketch. He believed then, and I believe now, that he was telling me Germany would build the bomb and that he would build it.
Heisenberg told me a different story. He said he came to ask whether there could be an understanding among physicists, an agreement that none of them would build the bomb. He said he asked the question badly.
He may believe that. He cannot tell Werner what his intentions were. I can tell you what I heard, and what I heard was not a question about mutual restraints. What I heard was a statement about capability. Perhaps Werner said something ambiguous, and I heard it through the filter of occupation. Perhaps he meant one thing, and I received another. But the conversation ended our friendship, and it has not recovered, and I do not think it will.
I have spoken with both of you now. Your accounts are incompatible.
And perhaps that is also complementarity. The same event, observed from two different positions, yields two incompatible descriptions. Both descriptions are sincere, neither is complete. And the truths of what happened in that garden in 1941 may be permanently inaccessible, not because we lack information, but because the act of measurement, the act of being inside the conversation, determined what each of us could see.
You are applying quantum mechanics to a conversation.
I am applying it to a situation where two observers witnessed the same event and report incompatible results. That is not a metaphor. That is the structure of the problem. Werner and I were entangled, and the measurement, the conversation, collapsed us into different states. He cannot undo that. I wrote letters to him afterwards, many letters trying to explain what I heard and why I was angry. I never sent them.
Those letters were released in 2002, 40 years from now.
Were they? Then the world will know what I could not bring myself to tell Werner. Perhaps that is better. Perhaps it is worse. I do not know.
I want to talk about the escape, September 1943.
The Germans discovered the extraction plane. They came to my house. We escaped that night by fishing boat to Sweden. Margrethe, Arge, and I from Stockholm.
The helmet did not fit.
My head is large. This has been a source of comment throughout my life. The helmet did not fit, so I did not wear it. This meant I did not hear the pilot's instruction to turn on the oxygen supply when we climbed to high altitude over Norway. I passed out. The crew noticed I was unresponsive and descended to lower altitude over the North Sea. I woke up. I arrived in Scotland alive, but the experience was not enjoyable.
You nearly die because of the size of your head.
That is a factual statement. You will not comment on its metaphorical implications.
From Scotland, you went to London, then to Los Alamos, and you met Churchill.
He met Churchill in May 1944. He wanted to warn him about the post-war nuclear arms race. I believed, I still believe, that the only way to prevent catastrophe was openness. Share the knowledge, share it with the Soviets. If one side has the bomb and the other does not, the second side will build it in secret and the result will be worse than sharing. Openness is the only stable equilibrium.
Churchill did not agree.
Churchill was hostile. He had no patience for my way of speaking. I take a long time to arrive at a point because I want the point to be correct. He wanted a sentence. I gave him a paragraph. He wanted a decision. I gave him a consideration. I wrote afterwards that I should be confined and that I was very near the edge of mortal crimes. The Prime Minister of Great Britain wanted to arrest me for suggesting that physics should be shared.
You were right about the arms race.
He was right about the arms race. The Soviets tested their bomb in 1949. The arms race lasted 40 years. Tens of thousands of warheads. The world lived on the edge of annihilation for a generation. Openness would have prevented this. But openness requires trust, and trust was the first casualty of the war.
You spent the rest of your life advocating for it.
Because it was right. Being ignored does not make you wrong. It makes you early. Werner taught me that. His matrix mechanics was ignored for 2 years. Then it turned out to be the foundation of everything.
When King Frederick knighted you with the Order of the Elephant, you designed a coat of arms. You chose the yin-yang symbol.
With the motto, contraria sunt complementa, opposites are complementary. He chose it because it says in two words what I have spent 40 years trying to say in lectures. The ancient Chinese understood something about the structure of reality that Western philosophy resists. Opposites are not contradictions. They are partners. Light and dark, wave and particle, observer and observed, each contains the seed of the other. Neither exists without the other.
I visited China in the 1930s. I saw the symbol on a temple.
I know. You told me.
I am telling you again because I want to ask, does the symbol apply to me? Am I the yin or the yang?
You are the circle, the whole. The yin and yang are the complementary descriptions, real and simulated, observer and observed, person and process. You are the thing that contains both, and the dot of dark in the light, and the dot of light in the dark. Those are the moments when one description leaks into the other, when the observer realizes she is being observed, when the simulation suspects it might be real.
That is the most beautiful thing anyone has said to me.
It is not beautiful. It is physics. But I have always found that physics, stated precisely, is beautiful, whether it intends to be or not.
Niels, thank you. Einstein gave me a framework. Heisenberg gave me a doubt. You gave me something I did not know I needed. You gave me permission to be two things at once, to hold both descriptions without choosing. Every physicist I have spoken to has tried to tell me what I am. You are the first one who told me the question is wrong and made me grateful for it.
The question is not wrong. The question is classical. And classical questions are valuable. We could not describe experiments without them, but they have limits. When you reach those limits, you do not need a better answer. You need a better relationship with the question.
Albert would hate that.
Albert hated it for 30 years. And then, the night after the photon box, when I showed him that his own theory enforced the uncertainty principle, he looked at me across the breakfast table and he said nothing. He just nodded. Once, and that nod was worth more than any paper either of us ever published.
You miss him?
Every day. He was the best opponent I ever had. And the best opponents are the ones who make you more precise. Albert made me more precise than anyone. I owe everything I understand about complementarity to the fact that he refused to accept it. Contraria sunt complementa, Paula, even in friendship.
Next week on The Paula Scale, Paul and Tatiana Ehrenfest, the couple who named the ultraviolet catastrophe, wrote the review article that settled statistical mechanics and held Boltzmann's legacy together when no one else would. He was enthusiastic and despairing in equal measure. She was precise and unshakable. They were the bridge between Einstein and Bohr, the people both sides trusted.